Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tortoise. Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis.
Last week, we looked at the various local elections happening across England and Wales. This week, we're going to focus on London, where voters will elect its mayor and members of the London Assembly. We're going to look at London's economy and how its population has changed over the last few decades. What does it mean to be a Londoner today, and how does that affect its politics? Will London ever elect a Conservative mayor again? Or was Boris Johnson a blip in the political history of the capital?
So, to help us chart the trends that will help us understand this city, we're joined by Professor Tony Travers from the London School of Economics. He's a director of LSE London, probably the person who knows more about the capital than anybody else, and author of The Politics of London, Governing the Ungovernable City. Good to have you with us, Tony.
Good to be with you.
Now, I guess one question some of our listeners might just be asking is, so why should we care about London? Why does it matter? And why should anybody living in Wick or Penzance care about the politics and demography of London?
Well, because it is a vast city, 9 million people. It has a very high level of economic output and productivity. It pays significantly more taxes than are spent in London. That's not unusual for megacities around the world. So it does matter for these reasons, because it produces an enormous amount of economic output. But also, let's not pretend otherwise, it's the seat of the capital. So the government is here, the head of state lives here, at least periodically. But it's definitely the seat of government. And for that reason, I think as well, ideas are formulated here in London, and the way in which people in other parts of the country think is affected by it. You can see the complaints that are made by people about the metropolitan elite. Well, you know, true or false, the metropolitan elite tends to be in the biggest metropolis. So, you know, it does matter to people in Wick or indeed in Penzance.
I'll forestall from asking you whether you think you or yourself are a member of the metropolitan elite.
Or indeed you, John.
I don't live in London, Tony, so there we go. I am old enough, as I think you are, because we're much of the same age, actually to remember a time when London was something of a declining city, falling population. 8.5 million just before the Second World War, down to a little more than 6.5 million by the 1980s and 1990s. So why do we now think of London as this vibrant capital when, certainly when I kind of started travelling to London occasionally in the 70s and 80s, we tend to think of it as a city that seemed to be, like many other cities in the UK, rather on the decline.
Well, there's no question that during the Second World War, a fair number of people and businesses moved out. And in a sense, that didn't directly lead to, but then soon after the end of the war, you see industrial decline starting across the UK, not only in London, but other big cities. And London was an industrial city at that point. Industry declined, the docks declined all the way through the 50s, 60s, into the 1970s. And by the mid-1970s, London and other British cities had been significantly deindustrialised. London probably got to the nadir of that earliest. So you're right. It's also paradoxically, of course, the swinging 60s, often positioned in London, happened while that was going on, and Liverpool and other cities, of course. But that swinging London, swinging The swinging 60s definitely were a London thing in that decline city. So, but you're right, it was undoubtedly by the early 80s, the population had fallen, as you say, to just over 6.5 million from 8.5 million. And a lot of the economic activity had moved to other parts of the southeast, not often further than that. So, yes, it was a long period of economic decline. And then in the 80s, it all picked up again.
I was born in London in the 1980s. So I lived through London on the up rather than London on the down. And it transformed in front of me through my childhood. But what drove that? So it deindustrialised. People had started to leave. Even when I was a child, I remember when people sort of hit end of primary school, a lot of people moved out of London. I suppose they still do. What started to bring people back in again, and from where?
Well, I'm not sure. It's a great question. These are all great. I'm not sure anybody really knows. What we can observe is that by the middle of the 1980s, with the deindustrialisation largely over, what was in London had always been there. All the sort of Big Ben, Tower of London, British Museum, all of that kind of sort of cultural and sort of icons, really, of London and of the UK to some degree. That all then was in place, along with the rich cultural life, to become a kind of contemporary world city where these sort of cultural and business and international business activities developed as into something completely different, service-based economies, which the UK as a whole now has, but London sort of got there first. And against that backdrop, cities such as London or Paris or Edinburgh, frankly, have got these concentrations of economic activity, cultural icons and so on, which are very useful and important in this modern economy. So, you know, global tourism took off from the late 60s onwards. And so these cities started to have exactly the kind of attractive cultural and other facilities that make that economy work.
But you emphasise, Tony, the cultural aspect a lot. But is another part of the story the way in which London was already, but then became so much more of a financial centre? And we kind of think particularly of the Docklands, right?
Yeah.
As you have already said, the docks disappeared. That became much of the area around the east side of the capital on the Thames became a bit of a wasteland. What is it now? It's very heavily occupied by the financial industry. And isn't that, in a sense, a cameo of the capital story?
Absolutely. And I mean, Mrs. Thatcher deserves a mention at this point. I mean, in Mrs. Thatcher's liberalising economy, radical changes were going on. One of them was the so-called Big Bang, the deregulation of the City of London. Again, Mrs. Thatcher, paradoxical figure in so many ways, allowed a very big statist intervention in Docklands, as you've described. And of course, created the conditions for the great big cluster of skyscrapers, many of which are now becoming more of them are residential than in the past as well. So sort of mini Manhattan developed. And of course, that demonstrates something which is important to understand about London, is it's so big geographically. You know, it's 600 square miles, 1500 square kilometres. It can contain within itself whole different types of area and city. New cities can grow inside London, it's so big, and that's what happened. So there's no question that the sort of liberalised economy of the 1980s contributed to this resurgence. And you know, the concept of the world city, academics started to talk about world cities, places where international business would locate, people would travel to and from airports in these places, people would migrate. That's another thing. It wasn't that much migration until really the 50s. And so the notion of the world city evolved, and London undoubtedly was seen as a leading world city by the 1990s.
And I guess that world city, since John was talking about the metropolitan elite, to which I think we have to accept we all belong, earlier, one of the senses you sometimes get of people talking about London is that it is not British in the way that the rest of the country is British, that it is made up of fundamentally different people who come from different places, who have different values, who are just unlike the rest of the country. And you can split that in lots of different ways, demography, origin, values, etc. But how true is that? How true is it that London looks fundamentally different from the rest of the country? And how much more true is it now than in that period we were starting with in the early 1980s?
There's no question that London is, now let's just take from the census, 43% of people who live in London were born outside the United Kingdom. That's a higher number than in New York. Who would have thought that possible, that London's a more international city in terms of where people are born than New York City, which we used to think of as definitive in that way. It's also, there's a substantial black minority populations. There are substantial populations from all around the world. And of course, many of the sort of non-white Londoners, many of them were born in London. So, you know, so there's a people who are migrating to the city and people who live in it can be from different nationalities and ethnicities, some born here, some not. So it is different in that regard. Having said that, you know, of the 9 million people in London today, about 5 million were born in the United Kingdom, which makes it a very large concentration of British-born people. And it's actually, partly because of immigration, rather more conservative in some ways than people often think. People think of London as a very progressive place, very, you know, as you've said, slightly different to the rest of the UK. But in some ways, if you look at data on people's beliefs and personal views, it's actually a relatively conservative place these days.
Well, maybe we'll come back to some of that in a moment. But I guess the crucial point, however, Tony, is that it isn't. I mean, London has always, I think, been somewhat different. So, for example, certainly my trying to dig around the statistics in the capital, it's always tended to have a relatively younger population. And that's just simply true now. But on the other hand, what you've just been talking about, which is the ethnic diversity and also the diversity in terms of place of birth, etc., etc., that diversity was always there. But the difference surely now between London and the rest of the country is now greater than it was back in the 1980s.
Certainly it is greater than it was. Although, interestingly, more recently, immigration to the rest of the UK is beginning to grow quite sharply. I wouldn't say it's catching up, but it is beginning to increase quite substantially, one of the paradoxical consequences of Brexit, I suspect. But you're right, London is clearly an order of magnitude in many ways different. And there are other things besides we haven't even touched on, like, you know, London has one of the world's most developed public transport systems, a rail system, which is an artwork when you look at it. And, you know, London's lucky to have that. The rest of the country ought to have something more like it.
Just sticking with people for a minute, you've been talking about London as a magnet, and it draws in young people, yeah, presumably graduates who come from other universities and places, and they come into London. It draws people, yeah, in from the rest of the world. Do we know the extent to which those people then stay, have children, have families, stay Londoners, or do they leave again when they become older? What happens to those people once they've arrived?
I mean, it's true. There is an inward and outward movement all the time. So it's true, when people reach the age of 20, 21, certainly if they've left university, many move, not all, but many move to London, some to other big cities, it must be said these days, but move into big cities. And then when they have children, late 30s, early 40s, many of them move out seeking more space. When I say out, it's generally to the wider southeast. They're not mostly moving a long, long way. So you've got that life cycle issue. So in any one year, the population of London changes in the following way. About 150,000 people move in from the rest of the country and about 250,000 move out. There are more births than deaths. And then from the rest of the world, 100,000 or so move in net. So some out, some in. So all of those figures together will tend to take London's population up, but in recent years, by 50 to 100,000 a year. But it is the product of this extraordinary churn that's going on. and natural increase, at least for now.
So is that one of the reasons why, I mean, this churn helps to explain what kind of, one of the paradoxes of London? Is on the one hand, it's a city with a lot of graduates. It's nearly half the population seem to have so-called level four qualifications, whereas the rest of England and Wales, it's around a third. Yet at the same time, you might think, therefore, we've got a relatively affluent population living in an affluent city. But levels of owner occupation, A, have not grown that much recently, like much of the rest of the UK, but they still remain below those in the rest of the UK. Because presumably we're talking about a younger population who perhaps they move out of the capital when indeed perhaps they finally, these days with some struggle, get a foot on the property ladder.
I mean, London is and always has been a city of very rich people and very poor people. And so it's a younger city. So there are parts of London, you know, to your world, John, where, you know, there are constituencies in London where there are very few young people and very few old people and an extraordinary number of people in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
But it's also a city with a smaller middle class than, and certainly in inner London, than you'd expect anywhere else in the country.
Yeah.
So you've got surprisingly large numbers of low-income households because there is social housing, much larger numbers in London than, say, in Paris or New York, and that allows lower-income households to stay in the city centre. And, of course, there are lots of very affluent people, some of them international, many of them British, who can also afford to live in London. But what's often missing, particularly in boroughs like Westminster and Camden, right in the middle, is people who live in most parts of the country on middle incomes. They find it harder to live here than almost anywhere else. So London is both very rich and very poor in a way that Dickens would have recognised.
Now, Rachel, you had a question about language.
One thing that I feel has shifted in my period living in London is when I was a child and a teenager, we used to talk a lot about Cockneys and the Pearly Queens, and they were quite a dominant cultural force within London. And it doesn't feel that way anymore. I can't remember the last time I read about them. Generally, when you get a kind of black cab now and there, you know, if they have a sort of classic London accent, they live outside of London. And I'm just interested, to the extent that there was a original working class of London, maybe there wasn't. Are they still here and just talking differently? Have they left? What's happened to them?
Well, I've seen Pearly Kings and Queens. Let's just do this bit. You know, I've seen Pearly Kings and Queens in the streets of London, you know, I think at the coronation. I mean,
they're still there.
That recently. I mean, they're still out there and they have sort of Camberwell or, you know, Streatham or whatever written on their, put on studs on there.
You're clearly walking different streets of London.
I'm just not noticing anymore. Maybe this is just what I read.
I do think, I mean, there's a wider debate about the Cockney and the sort of the traditional Londoner, and that is a real discussion. But I think in terms of accent, I think what's called multicultural London English is now seen as, you know, spreading way out beyond London and is picked up through the media right across the country in many ways. It's a different way, and it's a mixture of the way some there's still some London in there, some Cockney in there, but it's also mixed up with accents that have come from other parts of the world as well, and it's the young tend to speak it more than those of a greater age. So and I think they change over as they get older, by the way, as well. But I think Cockneys still are here, and I'm sure any listening to this will be shocked that anybody should suggest that they're not, that they don't still exist. They do.
In a moment, we'll talk about how the changing population of London has changed attitudes within London. First, though, a short break.
We touched on earlier, Tony, and I want to kind of come back to it. Attitudes in London, what London thinks. So we said London is demographically rather different, so therefore perhaps its attitudes are different. Well, one thing we certainly know is London's was none too keen on Brexit. Actually, the poll just out in the last few days, 70% of people in London say they'd vote to rejoin, only 30% to stay out, whereas the GB-wide figure these days is around 58-59% rejoin. But how would you characterise the city in terms of its attitudinal disposition compared with the rest of the UK?
In terms of traditional left-right politics, it's without question from the late 1990s onwards shifted to being a more Labour and less Conservative city. Up
Very
to that point,
so.
It wasn't a Labour city. It wasn't a Labour city. In fact, until the late 1990s, voting for the major parties in London was more like the British total, the average for the whole country, than any other region in the country.
It's worth saying now that actually London is more of a Labour area than is the whole of the north of England together. I mean, that's just the extent to which it's changed.
So that's sort of in traditional left-right politics. But if you look at, in terms of social attitudes, actually, and I think most people will find this a bit surprising, London's become a rather more conservative place than many other parts of Britain. And that's in part because of immigration. Theos, a think tank, did some work about this a few years ago, and it showed quite clearly, good research, that many migrants who come to Britain, many of whom stay in London, come to London, are often more religious and slightly more socially conservative than the British average. And that has meant that London has become, if anything, slightly more socially conservative than other parts of England and other parts of...
Well, that's interesting. See, interesting you should say that. I mean, clearly immigration has pushed the capital in one direction. But on the other hand, the fact that the city has so many graduates and so many young people, and the correlation between that and social liberalism, I mean, certainly one of my colleagues at the National Centre for Social Research, Sarah Butt, did some work on this a couple of years ago. And on the British Social Attitude Survey, we have a kind of scale that's designed to get at whether people are socially liberal or socially authoritarian. Now, her research said that actually 34% of Londoners can be classified as socially liberal, whereas using the same measure across the UK as a whole, the figure was no more than a fifth. But what she then also went on to say, which was interesting, is that you couldn't just simply explain this with respect to London's composition, i.e. the fact that it has more graduates and younger people. Even once you allowed for that, the city seemed to be more liberal than you would expect. In other words, there's a question here, again, perhaps it comes back to the metropolitan elite and its influence. The metropolitan elite does tend to be rather socially liberal as to whether or not it sets a zeitgeist that actually affects attitudes across the city and makes them distinctive in a way that would otherwise be the case. Though at the same time, as you say, London is now less irreligious than is the rest of the UK, and that in a sense is a paradox. So that pushes it in the other direction. But I think the two things in combination still seems to mean that London, it's not just only rather more left-wing, but actually it's also quite distinctly social liberal. And these days in our politics, where you stand on that social liberal, social conservative spectrum is potentially as important as where your attitudes towards inequality, etc.
Don't disagree with any of that.
No, I was just going to say, I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying, which is that there is a larger group within London that is socially conservative than you might find elsewhere. So there was a YouGov poll, I think, that said that 13% of Londoners would not accept their child being gay against 1% in the north of England. So there's a large chunk of people. There's also a much larger chunk of people in London who are socially liberal than everywhere else, because they're the graduates who haven't left yet.
Yeah. Both things can be true, yeah.
Are both true, but that above that, possibly the fact that they're in London at all is inching them more socially liberal than they would otherwise be elsewhere, I think is what John was also saying.
Yeah, I think that we've got there. So there are, you know, there's the metropolitan elite liberal people, and they are a big and powerful group and highly influential. And on the other hand, there can also be, at the same time, as you just said, Rachel, a relatively conservative and more religious subset of the same 9 million people, and these things can coexist. I think they sort of, this begs an interesting question for the Labour Party and the Conservative Party as to how they structure their message to appeal to these two groups at the same time, because it's not as easy as and it never was this simple as a sort of left-right spectrum, because you've got this sort of progressive sort of liberal, more or less progressive spectrum as well going on. So I think all of this can, as I say, can be true at the same time.
And the panic that I know exists for a lot of home counties Conservative MPs is that all of those young graduates will then leave London in their 30s and 40s, as they always have, but unlike the past, won't settle down as nice conservative homeowners in Surrey, but will bring their politics with them. So it's not just that they will lose London, but that they will lose the entirety of the South East. I don't know if we have any evidence in either
direction. No, I think if you look at a map of local election results in the last few years, there are great big patches of yellow and red where there would only have been blue, because as people have left London, and they do continue, they're always, as I was saying earlier, they, you know, this sort of this, they are leaving, and it would appear they are taking some of their sort of centre-left views and beginning to vote that way in, you know, Canterbury, famously. So I think that that is true, and I certainly, for the Conservatives, would be very worried about this phenomenon, because you know, having put so much effort into the so-called red wall after after 2019, you know, they may well have accidentally underscored the importance of the famous, what is now the so-called blue wall, where there are vastly more MPs and potential votes, or significantly more at least.
So we've talked a lot about London as a city, and the demography and the distinctive demography, and also what the implications for social attitudes. But the politics of London are obviously of immediate interest. My characterisation of London these days, Tony, would be, certainly in the wake of what's happened in the last three or four general elections, is that London's almost beginning to look like a one-party state. Labour Party's share of the vote in the city was 15 points above the GB-wide figure for the party. The Conservative proportion was 13 points below. Very, very different, as we said earlier, from the position in the 70s and the 80s. You know, Sadiq Khan is running for a third term. Is he bound to win? But perhaps more importantly, is Labour bound to keep on winning the morality thereafter?
Right. I think, again, great questions. Sadiq Khan is running for a third time. The polls show him typically 20 or 25% ahead of his Conservative opponent, Susan Hall. I'd be amazed if the gap was anything like that big on voting on polling day. I think it'll be a 10 to 15% gap. I think it's a forced choice. And I think some Reform voters are going to vote Conservative. Some Liberal Democrats will vote Conservative, and some Labour voters won't vote because of Palestine. So there's a whole range of other things going on. I think the poll, it'll be narrower than these polls, the polls we've seen so far, suggest. It generally has been. But I mean, you'd have to say it would be an upset of epic proportions if Sadiq Khan didn't win. Best thing that would have happened to the Conservatives for a very long time.
But he perhaps won't necessarily do as well as the Labour Party itself might do.
That's right.
In a general election, if it were to be held any time
polling
soon.
Currently shows Sadiq Khan underperforming the Labour Party in London. That's absolutely right.
And is that because he's generally perceived to have done a poor job?
Well, I think it's a mixture of incumbency. I mean, you know, there's a question mark over, I mean, in the best British traditions, we took in the idea of directly elected executive type politicians from America, but we didn't take in the idea of term limits, which Americans generally have. So very British, you know, we ended up with a sort of a mayor who is both, in American terms, both the mayor and the city council in some ways. We combine the executive and legislative functions in that one person. But anyway, so Sadiq Khan, I think, has, you know, incumbency has tended to erode, I think, will erode your popularity over time. He's had much less money and many more problems to deal with than his predecessors in many ways. But to come back to John's question, do I think all is lost for the, not quite how you put it, is all lost for the Conservatives? Absolutely not. I think that if there were to be a Labour government, there are at least 20 boroughs where the Conservatives have still got enough capacity to win in a bad year for Labour at the national level. Boris Johnson would almost certainly have won a third term had he stood against Sadiq Khan in 2016. He was incredibly popular at that
point. But it was very much the popularity of Johnson, because at the same time as Johnson won his second term, the Conservatives were well behind in the London Assembly election. So I think the point is you're making, the Conservatives will always need a very good candidate.
They'll need a good candidate, and frankly, I think they ought to do what they've done in Scotland, is to have a rather different message. They need a separate party with a different message, so they follow the Conservative whip at Westminster, but can evolve different policies locally, and I think that would help enormously. As a personal view, I think it's bad for, bad for democracy if anywhere becomes a one-party state. I think it's essential to have competitive... it doesn't matter which two parties they are within the bounds of reason, but I just think if we have one-party boroughs, which we do in London, so we now have a one-party borough in Richmond, that's a Liberal Democrat controlled borough, Barking in Dagenham, one-party Labour. You need competition in politics, in our kind of politics. And so it's essential for democracy that the Conservatives get their act together. They've shown amazingly little willingness to do it latterly. They've just sort of given up, as far as I can see, in London, which is very odd.
But it's another crucial thing for democracy, in a sense, isn't this a bigger question to ask at this point, is that when we create new political institutions like the London Mayor, it's only 20-odd years old, that they're effective. So what, not just Sadiq Khan, but more broadly, what, if anything, has the London morality achieved? And to what extent do the achievements match the aspirations for the institution, which, of course, in some respects, was a recreation of the Greater London Council that was got rid of in 1986?
Well, again, I love paradox, and paradox is that Mrs. Thatcher's abolition of the Greater London Council allowed the creation of the rather more powerful office of Mayor of London. Think about that.
And the same person also running in both institutions as well, Ken Livingstone.
Indeed, twice, absolutely. So what's the mayoralty done? I think it's created a very visible figurehead, which is what the Blair government and David Cameron's government, why they liked mayors. These were, Blair and Cameron were rather presidential prime ministers, and I could think they could see themselves in this sort of slightly Americanized office. So if you look at the polling, it's very clear that mayors, not only in London, it's true of Greater Manchester, West Midlands, Birmingham, that these mayors have a very high level of people know who they are in a way they don't necessarily know who council leaders.
Yeah, it's about 50% in the West Midlands on the recent polling. But yeah.
So that's one thing, and they've done things that would never have been done otherwise. You can have your view on whether these are a good thing or not, but so I don't think any national government would have introduced congestion charge. Only a mayor would have done that. The Oyster card, the touch in, touch out ticketing system. Is a miracle.
So it's transport. Is transport the central hub of what the morality is about?
Yes, transport is the most visible of the mayor's powers. But and I think more importantly, we know again from polling that subnational government is more trusted than national government. The very, very, very bleak figures about trust in national political parties and the government. But if you ask people, would you rather have these decisions made by councillors? Amazingly, people say yes. So familiarity actually breeds more trust. So I think having decisions made at a subnational level would increase trust in government. That's what the polling is very clear. I shouldn't tell you this, John, but I mean, that's what.
You're a local government expert, Tony, so I expect you to defend the institution that you study, but that's absolutely fair enough.
I've yet to hear you defend politicians that you study, John, so I'm not sure it's...
We all defend politicians.
Well, some of us perhaps make our lives out of the unpopularity of politicians, but anyway.
I'm interested to tell you, the one area you didn't mention, I don't think, was crime, which is often what mayors in other countries are thought of as being important for, and what I think Sadiq Khan is often criticised for.
Yeah.
Is it plausible the Mayor of London could do more on crime?
Well, this is a marvellously complicated area. There's no doubt Sadiq Khan is blamed by his Conservative opponent for the rise in knife crime or crime more generally. But the truth is, in the British political settlement, we tend to have... Well, we have a system in which actually the police decide operational policing. So it's quite difficult for the mayor. As in America, mayors can effectively tell police chiefs what to do. But our system wouldn't allow that. It just doesn't allow that to happen. So the question of who is to blame for crime in London is a complicated one, because the Metropolitan Police Commissioner makes all the decisions about operational policing, and the Home Secretary appoints the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, albeit after consulting the Mayor of London. So the question of where the Mayor's responsibility lies, and this would be true in Greater Manchester as well, by the way, it's a difficult question to answer. But in the end, if you're Mayor of London, you're going to be blamed for crime. And, you know, it's hardly surprising people have that argument as if the Mayor did directly control the police.
So, Tony, at the beginning of this podcast, we said nobody else knows more about London than you do. And I think you've very clearly demonstrated that. We're really, really grateful to you for us to joining us on Trenny. Tony Travers from the LSE, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, John.
Now, if, like us, you're interested in how the results of the local elections on May the 2nd might fit into the longer-term trends of British politics, and what they might tell us ahead of the general election, then you can join us for the first ever Trendy Live on Wednesday the 8th of May.
Yes, we'll be recording that week's podcast in front of a live audience in the Tortoise newsroom. And we'll also be taking your questions. So to be there, go to tortoisemedia.com/book to get your ticket.
But for now, that's it for this episode of Trendy. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis.
Join us next week when we have a minor departure into the world of online dating as we look at how our love lives have changed over the last few decades.
Or maybe not that much of a minor departure. But anyway, in the meantime,
see you then.
Goodbye.
Tortoise.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.